Greetings. I am Shusada Kona Kumara. Welcome to Satsang. You are beginningless. You are endless. You are divine.
Good evening, everybody. This is Shusada Kona Kumara. Thank you for joining us for Satsang again tonight. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like you to take a nice deep breath, and I will clear the space. Mother, Father, God, that I am, through the great central sun hierarchy, through the office of the Christ, through the order of Melchizedek, I call upon Archangel Michael to bring the sapphire blue ray. Cut away, cut away, cut away anything in all of our four lower vehicles not emanating directly from our I Am presence. I now call on Archangel Ezekiel, keeper of the violet flame. Blaze, blaze, blaze the violet flame through all of our four lower bodies. Transmute, transmute, transmute all the psychic debris Michael has cut free. And now bring forth the invincible ring past knot and the mirror blue light of invisibility to completely surround each of us. And I call forth a shaft of pure Christ light, one to surround each one of us, and I ask that they be brought to the center of the earth, where I call on Archangel Gabriel to seal them. And I ask that the legions of Michael completely surround each tube of light. And now I ask that our vibrations be raised high above the psychic and astral worlds to the highest realm of illumined truth we each can attain at this time. And now, Mother, Father, God, we place ourselves in service to you and to humanity. And I place myself in service to all of those listening tonight. We ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted into our perceptions and that all else of the lower mind be kept out. And we ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted through us. And because we have asked this, we consider it so. So be it. Good. So the energies are crazy. Really, really crazy. I was just saying to PLAN between our sessions that I wouldn't anticipate much letting up between now and the end of the year. just a little heads up. And that's okay. It's good. Remember, it's always good to have things brought up for clearing, right? It was funny when I think it was between sessions when was it? No, I think it was at the meditation at the end of our Charlotte session here. This kind of thought came in and I was dancing with it for a minute, and it was looking at the world as like an out picturing of God's tough love. Right? And so it was like, you have to remember that in everything here in the world of illusion, where you are truly looking at the shadow side of what is, right? So everything that is real and true, you're experiencing the polar opposite of it here in the world. And it's not real. It is shadow. But it appears very real, certainly from the vantage point of the lower mind that's identified here. But within it is always the gift. The gift is always present. You know, love is, and love is always present. And even within the illusion itself, it's there. And that's what it was funny. It kind of came as like, oh, tough love. And maybe it was because during our session, we were talking about how after reaching the state of loving equanimity where you're capable of functioning on that level. After that point, another level of functioning can come forward, which is that aspect that can take right action. You know, it can see clearly and can weigh all factors and take right action in a moment. And that was the piece where I saw, oh, like, there it is. It's like, and I always come back to Jesus in the temple. It's like that. I always come back to that one moment, because of course that's the moment you see him, quote unquote, angry, right, in the Bible. And of course, in his righteous anger, he didn't lose sight of who anybody was. He didn't judge the moneylenders on a personal basis, right? And think of them poorly. He didn't identify with the story. None of it. But what he did do was bring a level of understanding to the situation that consciousness, as locked in that identified version of the moneylenders, needed to see. And that is tough love, right? He came in, you know, like the, we'll call him a badass, right? In that moment. And I think it's beautiful. And people want to kind of turn Yeshua into a human in that respect of, oh, look at him, he got angry too. But they don't understand that it didn't come from a personal place. It wasn't that. It was because he was capable of being detached from all of it, that aspect of the divine came through like that. And people get really, really hung up when they can't recognize that there is a level of everything that can outpicture as the divine here. I think often of, you know, Michael with his sword. You know, it seems very violent, doesn't it? And indeed, it does. But he is the, the outpicturing of the will of God. And sometimes it looks violent here, yeah, because it plays the role it needs to play within the story. So, what was my point? Did I have one? Typical. Even Megan's going, I really don't know. You're kind of all over the place. The energies and they're, oh, tough love. And I was saying, yeah, right. So the gift is always present. I think that was my point, that even within all of the ugly, the gift is there. It's always there. It can't not be there. Is it real? No, none of it's real. But within the reality that the identified self experiences here, it's still a gift, you know? And so many people get stuck in depression and stuck in all these spaces. And if they could just kind of shift their perspective just ever so slightly to see that in all of the pain that they experience and in all of the suffering that they appear to be sitting in, that the key to their freedom is right there in the experience. It's in the pain, yeah? It's in the suffering. Well, that doesn't feel good. That's okay. It doesn't need to feel good. Who cares if it feels good or not? Yeah? Ooh, I don't know about that. I'm not so sure about that whole who cares if it feels good or not. But have you ever sat and looked at the feeling objectively? Have you ever sat in a place where you experience pain on some level and then really looked at it? And I'm saying I'm hurting. But then if you back up and just sit and look, who's really hurting? Yeah. Who hurts? And in the story that might say, my boyfriend broke up with me and I'm devastated. Okay, good. So let's sit in the devastation, right? Let's sit in it. Oh, I feel like my heart's being ripped out of my chest. It's terrible. Okay. So be present with the pain. And what can it show you? If you really get present with the pain, it's going to show you that it really doesn't even exist. Because once you look at it head on, see, this is the thing. We all look at it sideways, you know, because no one really wants to look at it head on. If you look at it head on, void of a story, and just look at it as pain, where does it exist? And I hope you all in this moment are taking some story where you either are currently experiencing pain or have experienced pain in the past, and taking what I'm saying and kind of attach it to that and look at it. Find the place of pain and just sit with it and look at it. Where does it exist? And there's only one place it exists. People go, oh, it's in my heart. It's not in your heart. Look at it. Where does it exist? What is it that brings the pain forward? The only thing that's going to bring pain forward is a thought or a picture. And they're both kind of the same thing anyway, right? A picture of a past memory, a thought of a past something, or even a projection of a future, maybe non-something, that is the effect of the cause of the pain, right? Okay, so now let's look at that. If we peel the picture away, if we dissolve out the story, what happens to the pain? The pain goes completely. And what are you left with? You're left with now. Because there can't be pain without a story. I'm talking mental, emotional pain. Yeah. There is no suffering, even physically, without a story. There can be physical pain, but there's no personal suffering if there is no story that's been identified with and attached to. I mean, really look at that. This is very deep. So really look at it. Look at your story. He did this and it hurt me. Okay. Why did it hurt? Because I believed something, right? Because I believed something. And it was that belief that set me up to be hurt. If you peel away the belief and the same thing had been done, would it have hurt? Not necessarily. This is why you'll have two completely different people with different belief systems, right? And you'll have one incident that happens and one person doesn't mind at all, no big deal. And then the other person is like seriously offended, right? It's just because of the belief that's held. So the belief is the cause of the pain. It's not the other person. It's the belief that causes the pain. You see, because you hold a belief tightly, the belief is there to give you a sense of self. It's there to shore up this concept of who I am, quote unquote. And that's all well and good. Well, what happens when the belief is challenged? Now there's pain. In the moment the belief is challenged, the pain arises. And then that pain can be brought forward through your emotional body in lots of different ways, right? It could be terrible guilt, or it could be rage, or just minor irritation. Deep sadness, right? It can outpicture in all kinds of different ways. But if it wasn't for the belief that sits there, there wouldn't be pain. Can y'all see that? Just through the way I'm speaking it, makes sense. You can follow it. Good. Excellent. So now let's take it a step further. If the belief is the source of the pain, how does it serve you to hold the belief? Oh, does it? What does the belief serve to do? It only serves to do one thing. It serves to hold you separate. That's it. You see, without a belief, an action can happen around you, and it happens, and there it is, and it's accepted for what it is. End of story. Really kind of non-story. With a belief in place, action happens in the outside world, and now the identification happens that shows that it's in conflict with what is. And in that moment, separation gets reinforced because you did that to me. And now I can't see you as me. I can only see you outside of me. And I have to blame outside of me, because the blaming outside of me allows me to feel good about the belief that I'm holding that keeps me in pain. So on that level, all these the judgments that we pass, and then the justifications that we come up with that allow us to feel good about our judgment, is a really twisted thing. You end up feeling good about holding into place the thing that hurts you. How masochistic is that? Truly. Yeah. When you really look at it, it's the belief that hurts, right? It's the belief that is the source of the pain. Every time, every time, every time, every time. Megan was sharing with us earlier an experience that she had outside of mind. Truly beautiful. And then experiencing the re-engagement of identification. And in the re-engagement of identification, experiencing how anger came forward, right? Why? Because she believed something again. The belief was, I lost it. The belief was, I'm not there anymore. The belief is, I can't get back there. The belief is, I'm not good enough. You name it, and it keeps going, right? And every single one of those beliefs that get presented as actual thought that runs through your awareness is a source of pain. So tell me again how it serves you to believe in anything. Right? And it's not as simple as saying, oh, well, okay, I can see that. It's intellectual enough, right? Practical enough. Justin likes practicality. It's practical. I get it. So I'll just stop believing in everything. Done. Right? Easy. It'd be nice if it was that easy. But it's not. It takes very deep self-inquiry to get to a place where you don't think that you are the doer that's going to get rid of it, right? What actually happens is something observes the dissolution of it. The you that's believing the story is not the thing that leads to the end result of the story falling away. It looks like it, doesn't it? You know, it looks like you're showing up and doing all this spiritual work and all this stuff is happening. And on a level for you, that will be true, right? But that's not the thing that leads to the dissolution. Because remember, you aren't learning anything new. You're not coming into a state of awareness so much as throwing off the pieces that have kept you from being that awareness. Because you are that awareness that hasn't gone anywhere. Right? Where would it go? There's nowhere to go. There's a very good reason that traditionally the sages and the saints would kind of refer to this movement of consciousness as waking up, because it's literally how it's experienced. a moment of awakening, you know. There's nothing you have to take on as you. We're not here to add to your belief system. We're not here to get you to take on a teaching and now have to hold another piece. Now, it may look like that for a time, right? Because I have to give you understandings, which can feel like being taught something. But ultimately, that's not what's happening. The only thing happening is that identified consciousness is throwing off layers and layers and layers and layers of belief. And at the end of the day, what's left is what you are by your nature. You know? Outside of concept. You know, and to be outside of concept in a world of concept is quite something. But all the masters will tell you that, you know, all the teachings are the same. There is, you know, everything is possible in God, right? And everyone understands that. We've all heard that. Well, it's true. Well, you know, you say that. No, it's actually true. With God, all things are possible, right? That's the way you always hear. Yeah. Because what are we going to say? That I'm God, but as God, I'm incapable of this, that, or the other thing? And I don't think so. But there's the disconnect between the identified small self and the self with a capital S. Well, because there has to be, because the small self doesn't even exist. So capital S self fell into the dream of separation, where it identified with a story. And the story is based on what? A belief. And what is the belief? The belief is that I'm separate from all that is. Very simple. Actually, to go even further with it, the belief is I. All right? It's one letter, I. And in just that one belief, it becomes entrapped into a mode of perception that is completely faulty. So when consciousness shifts its perception from something that's faulty to an accurate way of perceiving what is, the experience of awakening is very much felt. How many times do you have the aha moment and you go, oh, I see? Yeah. Different level of perception, right? I see. I get it. That's another good way, you know, I get it. It's like there's this internalization that goes, like, I own that. I get it. Yeah, that's right. And of course, for a time after the I get it moments, you know, the veils come down again. And you move again through these stages, like Megan was sharing. I've lost it. You lost it? How can you lose what you are? You didn't lose anything, right? It's actually the opposite. If anything, it's I took it on again, right? I didn't lose what I am. I took on something I'm not. Yeah. And in a moment, that's it. And that's it. That's all there is to it. So the thought arises, it's gone, and you're already trapped. How could something be gone? If it exists, and it truly exists, how could it be gone? It can't be gone. Where would it go? Right? Justin, you're a big ACIM guy. What's that quote from Jesus? Nothing. Come on, help me. Yeah, yeah. Say it here.
It's nothing. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God.
Okay, so nothing real can be threatened. So in Megan's experience of quote-unquote being that and then losing that, is it true? No. If nothing real can be threatened, there's nothing quote-unquote bad that's ever going to happen with reality, right? And then nothing unreal, what, exists? And nothing unreal exists. Oh, what does that mean? So the thought that says, I lost it, comes from the space that can't be real because it's based out of lack. So how could it exist? Right? It's just a thought. It's just a thought. It's the only the identification with the thought that makes the thought seem accurate, right? Or real. If you knew yourself to be God, and let's just, we'll play with it, okay? So, Megan, you know yourself to be Wonder Woman, right? You are Wonder Woman, and you have all the powers of Wonder Woman. And Wonder Woman, as you hops in her airplane, her invisible airplane, right? And in a moment, the thought arises, I don't know how to fly this. And what does Wonder Woman do? That's ridiculous. Fly the plane. Because she's Wonder Woman, right? She knows how to fly her own plane. But that's exactly what's happening with consciousness here. You have an experience and a thought arises that says, I lost it. Right? Why identify with something that obviously is not accurate? Now, that's going to be a stretch because you're going to say, well, to me, it's not obviously accurate, right? But you see, the quote Justin just gave us here, and then at the end of it, herein lies the peace of God, right? If you know that both of these are true, where in there are you going to suffer, regardless of what seems to be happening? Yeah. So when the thought came for Megan, I lost it, why didn't she just laugh? It's ridiculous. Can't lose what I am. Regardless of what the experience of awareness is in this moment, you've never lost who you are. That's ridiculous. Yeah, it's ridiculous. There's a level of empowerment that has to come in at some point where you start to own your divinity. You understand? It's one thing to say, and this is why I've had my students stand in front of the mirror every day and look at it and say, I'm God. I am God. Right? And we've done it different ways. I am God. I am God. I am God. Right? And every way you change the subtleties of how you say it makes a different impact. And I do that with people because people will experience in the moment of staring themselves in the eyes and saying something so blasphemous as I am God, all this stuff comes up for them, right? Yeah. I've had students who literally said, I couldn't look myself in the eyes. I was so ashamed, you know, or it felt so ridiculous. I felt like such a fool. I'm like, how sad is that? Because it's the truth. You are that, right? That's the beauty when you look into the eyes of a sage, right? All they see is themselves in you, and all they see is you in them, and it's all God. There's nothing outside of that, right? Nothing outside of that. And people will have the experience of, wow, you know, it was like looking into eternity. Well, yeah. Because there's no identification there, nothing that looks at you and says, oh, you're this limited being, right? You're this, you know, mentally fragile little human that has all these problems. Oh, please. It's ridiculous. So beautiful that the sage can see that in you, but you've got to see that in you. You see? You wake up to your own divinity, and it has to be owned. It isn't owned from the space of ego that says, hey, aren't I great? No, not at all. Not at all. But if you can't own who you are, right? How do you ever expect to walk off the life-death cycle? If you can't stand in your own authority, how's that going to happen? Now, this is not a space most people are ready for, honestly. But I have to bring it forward because I don't know who I'm talking to out there. In the work, first you have to own all of your own shortcomings. Yeah, you've got to own all of your stuff, all the nasties that you don't want to come up against and work through and see through. You got to own that first. And beyond that, when that piece has pretty much dissolved out, now you get to own who you really are. And mind loves to play with that one too. Oh, I don't know if I can do that. I'm not really that, right? And isn't that what everyone believes? I want to believe that, but I don't really believe that. I get where maybe I could be like an ascended master, maybe that, you know, fell in consciousness, and I could kind of buy that. I'm walking my way back out again. But to own my own divinity? No. Nope. Too hard. Yep. But required. Required. There's no walking out of identification completely until you can own who you are. Now remember, the ego, you know, has like zero self-esteem. Zero. Like nothing. And what it creates for itself to build self-esteem is all faulty, and it's all kind of built on, it's like a house of cards, right? It doesn't take much to knock it down, because what sits underneath it is, I really don't like myself. I feel completely and utterly worthless. So that's humanity, and that's what the collective holds, right? Humanity as a whole feels worthless, and the individuated you feels the same way underneath everything. Now, you may have gotten really good at covering it up, and you may have gotten really good at, you know, temporarily holding kind of higher states, but it's always interesting. It doesn't take much of a trigger for someone to go right back down into it. Yeah, where you see this issue with self-worth. It doesn't take much at all. Every time you feel guilty, it's because you have no self-worth. Yeah. That it always comes back to, I did something wrong. I'm not good enough. Yeah. I can't. Right? That's a very disempowered place to sit. I can't. Very different from I won't. Right? A lot of times, I won't is just sitting over the top of I can't. So to say I am God and to know that it is 100% accurate is something that takes time to move into in this place of time and space. It's not an overnight thing for most people. And I say that because, of course, there are always exceptions. And I would place myself in one of the exceptions for that. I remember being little. What the heck book was it? There was a book that came out. It may have been, I think it was Illusions by Richard Bach. It's like one of my favorite books ever. But I think that came out in the 70s. And I remember reading. It's a little tiny book. It's, my mom was really big into more metaphysical kind of spirituality. So she got that book. And in that book, it said, I am God. And I remember reading it going, duh. Like, I so got that. I was like, well, yeah. How could there be anything outside of that? Right? Okay. So obviously there are those of us who had done so much work, you know, even in the fallen state that led us to the place where coming into this lifetime, we still carried that understanding. But for most, that's not the case. Right? Right. And that doesn't mean that those who come in with the understanding don't get imprinted from the time they're little going forward. You know, lots of when you hold yourself in a certain place and hearing, especially as a girl from other girls, oh, you're so stuck up or you're so conceited or right. You think you're so great. And that kind of stuff makes an impact on the psyche, obviously, especially when you want to belong and be accepted and liked and all that. So it doesn't mean that for those of us who came in with understandings that we didn't have to dissolve out all that junk that got placed between us and the understanding. Yeah. Because we've all had to. But it is there. And there's a part of it, and it's an interesting thing, I think, for all of you. If you put yourself in the space where you're just even, not even doing it, but thinking about it, you'll witness that it's like there's two dialogues that go on simultaneously. There's the one that knows it to be true, right? And it's kind of taking this little, like these very tepid steps forward going, yes, I am God. And there's the other voice going, no, you're not, cut it out. Right? Who are you kidding? You're a sinner. And you know what? You are. Yeah. In truth, by definition, of course you are. You've forgotten what you are. That makes you a sinner. You understand? So all of you who have your religious doctrination, let me correct that component. To sin is to miss the mark. That's what it means. And what is it to miss the mark when it comes to the mind? It means you've believed yourself to be something you aren't. That simple. It's nothing more than that. And it's very innocent. You know, religiously, we have this concept that to be a sinner makes you this horrendous, evil being. It's ridiculous. It's very innocent. You've only forgotten who you are from the most innocent of places. Right? From the most innocent of places. You made a false assumption and ran with it. Yeah? Oops. And look what we've turned it into. Right? Now you should be ashamed of who you are and should be ashamed of your birthright. Not to the point where you can't own it. It's your birthright to be divine. Your birthright. Oh. To live outside of polarization is your birthright. You understand? Just because your awareness is here doesn't mean it's trapped here indefinitely. That is not the case. It is your birthright to walk back into the state of knowing that you exist in. So own it. Yeah? Own it. You can't live in the state of, oh, I'm just this lowly seeker. And from the space of humility, it's beautiful because it requires that. In order to then be able to move into a place that is more empowered from a real place, understand? If the ego came into their spiritual work from the egoic, yeah, I got this, yeah. This is my birthright and I'm God and I'm making it happen, right? No, that's it, nope. No, because that ego's got to get knocked down a few pegs before it'll be ready to do the work necessary to then come into its knowing of who and what it is. It comes from humility. Is that a question or are you telling me I got 5 minutes? What? Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry. This actually just hit me because you do tell us to say, I am God in the mirror. What is the difference of saying I am God in the mirror as opposed to maybe just doing it as a mantra or saying it randomly throughout the day.
Okay, you tell me.
Damn it. Well, when I say it in the mirror, then I really have to look at myself.
Uh-huh.
And realize how I really feel about it.
Yeah. Does that happen if you're sitting in meditation doing a mantra over and over and over again? Mm-mm. All right. Question answered.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be a whole lot easier to sit across from another person and stare them in the eyes and go, "You are God. You are God." Well, sure. I can look at you all day long and say, "You are God." Ooh, but if I have to look at myself. Now, the cool thing about having a one-on-one and looking at someone and saying, "You are God," is now the other person has to be able to accept that coming at them. That's not always easy to do, right? Because I'll have someone, you could say that, and they'll be like, "Stop, you're making me uncomfortable," you know. "Ooh, that makes me uncomfortable. Tell me I'm God. Don't do that." And I had a beautiful moment with someone very dear to me many, many years ago, who was had been triggered by something, was extremely angry, was in a lot of pain. You know, remember, anger covers up pain. Was in a lot of pain. And in the moment, of course, this was 24 years ago, 23 years ago, something presented through me, and I looked at the person and I said, "It's not your fault, and God loves you." And the experience that the person had was, "Don't tell me that." That's what I got back immediately, just like, whoom. "Don't say that. Don't you dare tell me that. It's not true." And you see it? Because that's what sits there. What sits there is, what do I want? What I want more than anything in the world is to feel accepted and loved by God, right? Because there's an inner knowing of what you are, acceptance and love. But what the ego holds is that that thing that you're telling me loves me is the source of my pain. When we peel back all the layers, it's and I think it's my mother, and I think it was my father, and I think it was what they did to me, and I think it was all the situations that I had to deal with growing up, and the racism, and the this and the that. And when I peel it all away and someone says to me, "God loves you," and I say, "Don't say that." Yeah. Now we've hit it. Because that's the source of the pain. The source is the feeling of separation. That's it. Don't tell me God loves me. That's a bunch of crap. If God loved me, I wouldn't have had that mother, and I wouldn't have had the racism, and I wouldn't have had this, right? That's what comes out of it. And you've got to be able to bring yourself to look yourself in the face, because what sits there in the ego is just deep, deep shame. So much shame, right? So much shame. So much rage. You got to get through the rage to get down into the shame. And so for me to look at myself and have to be eye to eye with myself and say, "I am God," means I've got to be willing to look at all of that, right? Beautiful exercise. I would highly recommend that anybody do it. And not just once, right? And do it as an exercise. Journal about what happened. The first time I did it, I couldn't look myself in the eyes. Sit down and look at that. Why? Why can't I look at myself? Some people can't look at themselves in a mirror without saying anything. Yeah? I don't want to look at myself in a mirror. Why? What happens to you when you do? I hate myself so much, I don't even want to look at myself in the mirror. Oh my God. And that's the reality for a lot of people, right? But honey, you're beautiful. You're divine. You're God. Stop holding so much stuff against yourself, right? And all of this is taken on from such an innocent place. It's so innocent. And all the people who have hurt you in your life, they did that because that's what they were trained to do. And it happened to them, and it was so innocent there. You know? If you were raised to speak Spanish and you walked into my house and I spoke English to you and you spoke Spanish, would I hold it against you? Would you be wrong for being a native Spanish speaker if that's what you were taught? No. All right. So why are we holding it against everyone in the world for functioning at a level they were trained to function from? It's no different. I don't care what they're doing. I don't care how atrocious it is, because people are doing atrocious things on the planet. There's no question, right? But there's innocence underneath it. And until the collective can come to that understanding, we cannot make change on the planet. We can't. Because what did I say earlier? It's all about starting from the space of loving equanimity, right? And now, at that point, now you're ready to come in and function from a different place that actually can create change. Now you are the vanguard of God on the planet. If we're going to hold everything against people for how terrible they are, we're no different than them. Yes, outward actions may look different, but when you really get down to brass tacks, you're not any different. Right? We've got to see why people are the way they are. It's because they were taught to be that way. They didn't take it on by personal choice. They were taught to be that way. Right? And remember, the mind takes all of it on. So whatever you're holding consciously, you're holding the other side equally. And whatever happened to you, maybe now you hold this conscious side that says, I will never be that. But you know what? In a moment where you truly get triggered and reactive mind takes over, you're going to be that thing that you said you'd never be. That's why every mother in America and the world over has had the experience of, oh my God, I just turned into my mother. All right? Pillion's going, uh-huh. Because everyone has had an experience as a child where you're one of the parents or whatever did something and you couldn't stand it, and I will never do that. And lo and behold, you have a couple kids, and a few years later, all of a sudden, you find yourself doing that same exact thing you swore you would never do. Why? Because it's imprinted. And reactive mind is reactive mind, and it can only function from the program. Period. It's not capable of rational thought. It functions from a program. Right? Did you ask for that? No. Did it happen anyway? Yeah, it did. Right? So can we now stop kind of judging people for, you know, can we find some compassion? Just compassion. If you can just get to that space where you go, you know, as much as I hate what's happening there, and as much as it hurts me to know that that's going on, at least I can have compassion for the person who's doing the only thing they know to do and who has completely lost sight of who they are. Right? And you've got to function that way. Because for some of us who are really sensitive, the world is such a painful place to be. You know, I'm that way when especially when it comes to animals. I see any kind of thing happening to an animal, it literally hurts me, you know, physically. It hurts me to watch animals that are abused, you know, or hurt. I can watch a human be abused far easier than I can watch an animal be abused because they're so innocent. Yeah. Humans usually ask for it one way or another, seems like. But certainly seeing a baby that's abused, it's unconscionable, right? And for people who are sensitive, it hurts, right? So you have to, that's an understanding that you can take and bring it home, and you need to. For as much as I can't stand to know that this person did that to that child, I have to have compassion for the fact that he didn't know any different. And on top of that, no matter how it outpictures and no matter how it seems to be, I promise you, the person who's hurting other people or the person who's hurting animals, they're in some pain, or they wouldn't be doing it. They just wouldn't be doing it. they're in pain. You know, because how else could someone function like that? What has happened is the ego, right, has moved into the space of self-righteousness that is so strong that it literally is blocking out the experience of conscience. Her conscience is divine. It is God. Yeah. But for some, because of the pain, they literally, that's been the defense mechanism, the coping mechanism, has been to bring that level of self-righteousness up so strong that it occludes the experience of conscience. And why does that happen? Well, that happens in extreme situations, right? Those people have been hurt. A coping mechanism is a coping mechanism. And, you know, kids who are abused especially go through that all the time. You have to take on whatever you can take on that'll allow you to function, right, in the world. And that's great. It served you at a time. It was beautiful, right? But this is what it leads to. When it's real bad, that's what it leads to. So give them your compassion before your judgment, right? Know that the act is wrong, and the act is wrong, but have compassion for the person. Understand? And also know that it's all occurring exactly the way it's meant to. You don't know the karma between this person and the other person. You don't know what happened before that set things up to play out this way this time. Right? We look at the child and say, oh, it's so innocent. You don't know what happened before. Maybe that child was not so innocent before. And now it has to live out the other side of its own actions. Yeah. Always hold that. Because those things are the things that if you really hold on to, they'll keep you from really functioning from that self-righteous place yourself, where you just want to judge and make others wrong, you know. Remember, there's innocence in all of it. Ooh, there must be time. Is it time? Yeah. That's fabulous. All right, everybody. I picked a really fun song for tonight. We've done it before, but it's one of my favorites, so we're going to do it again for our ending meditation. Sit with the words. Let them fill you. And we'll be back with you next week. So much love to you. Good night.
You are divine.